Welcome to the Econews Report. I'm your host, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of the Environmental Protection Information Center. And I am thrilled to have a new voice on the podcast, Matt Simmons, who is the new legal fellow here at EPIC. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And we're going to be talking about Amy Coney Barrett and the potential risks that Amy Coney Barrett as a Supreme Court justice may have for the environment. She is currently a judge on the Seventh Circuit, I believe, was a professor at Notre Dame Law School. What else do we need to know about Judge Barrett's career?
So Judge Barrett is a self-described disciple of Scalia, Justice Scalia, who was a sort of arch conservative of the court for many years. And she's also a member of the Federalist Society, which, you know, sort of cues us into what her rulings will probably be like.
Yeah, and so I'm glad that you brought up the Federalist Society and her previous work for Judge Scalia, because this is a lot of speculation on our part, right? We don't know what Judge Barrett will do.
She's only been a judge for 2 years, so we don't have that much to go on.
And she is an appellate judge, so she has more power than other judges within our system, right? So we have district court judges. Those are the very basement entry-level courts. And then you have the appellate courts, which hear appeals, as the name suggests, from the district courts. And then you have the one court that shall rule them all, the Supreme Court. And so we've seen in time previously other judges who, upon their elevation to the Supreme Court, have made rightward or leftward tacks that they felt that they were bound by some previous other laws. But now that they are the law, was that Judge Dredd, they have a new interpretation of what the law means. So it's possible that Judge Coney Barrett is, you know, some sort of a Marxist and she's going to radically transform the law in a leftward direction. But it's probably pretty unlikely because of her past associations, from what we know about her academic or her beliefs via her academic writing when she was a professor at Notre Dame Law School, as well as her associations within the conservative legal movement beyond the Federalist Society, her clerking for Judge Scalia, and her grooming as a rising star in the conservative legal world. All of this gives us clues. And so we're going to be talking about the Federalist Society's dream for remaking the federal judiciary and for remaking federal law. So a lot of this is just pulled from what the Federalist Society believes. So Matt, again, what is the Federalist Society besides just a conservative legal think tank or whatever?
Sure. So for a long time, justices were appointed to the court because they were seen as good judges. And, you know, they had served for a long time. They were sort of well-regarded within the judicial community, and the president would choose them and just sort of hope that they were a good judge. And this caused people on the right a lot of ire, because you would have Republican presidents like Reagan appointing justices who went on to do things that the right in our society don't like, because they interpreted the law as allowing all sorts of things, abortion being probably the most prominent example right now. But there's a whole list of judges who were appointed by Republican presidents who went on to do things that Republicans don't like. And so the Federalist Society was specifically founded in order to groom law students and, you know, young lawyers who definitely hold the right views according to the conservative spectrum of our politics, so that you could pick these people to be judges, and not just Supreme Court judges, but all up and down the judiciary. You could pick these people to be judges, and you'd safely know that they would rule the way that the right wants them to. And so that is why her involvement in the Federalist Society, and not just hers, but Justice Kavanaugh's, Justice Gorsuch's, Kennedy, and Scalia were a little bit older than the founding of the Federalist Society, but they were heavily involved in the organization. It's all of them grouping together to make sure that they have the right people becoming judges that will rule the right way, according to them.
And President Trump, in appointing judges, has clearly made the Federalist Society's seal of approval an important part of his decision process in choosing a judge.
They gave him a list.
And Trump, I think, got a lot of bounce and a lot of excitement from conservatives in 2016 when he was running for president, because he had the list of judges. And there were people like Judge Amy Coney Barrett on that list of potential future Supreme Court justices. So she's actually been talked about as a potential Supreme Court justice even before she was on the federal court. When she was a mere law school professor, people were talking her up. Jumping from law school professor to Supreme Court isn't necessarily unheard of. Judge Kagan was dean of Harvard Law School, but that would have been a more substantial jump. So Amy Coney Barrett was first appointed to the Seventh Circuit, and now only 2 years after her appointment to the Seventh Circuit, she is being considered for elevation to the highest court on the land. So Federalist Society, they have a whole number of things that they have a bullseye on. And this is a lot of Supreme Court precedent, in part somewhat turning back the clock to an older era of thoughts on the role of the judiciary and the relative balance of powers between the three branches of government, the judiciary, the executive, and the legislative branches. So let's start with the non-delegation doctrine. And so for all of these things, I understand that you probably have maybe never heard about the non-delegation doctrine. Don't worry. You don't need to go to law school to understand it. It's pretty simple. You'll be the life of the virtual Zoom party that you'll have later this week when you tell your friends about the non-delegation doctrine. So Matt, what do we talk about when we talk about the non-delegation doctrine?
Yeah. So I think we've all probably seen the Schoolhouse Rock video of how a bill becomes a law. But then when you look out in the real world, that's not how most of our government actually works today. And this goes back to the New Deal is when it really started to take off. We started creating a lot of agencies that were supposed to be, you know, a more flexible arm of the government. Instead of having politicians have to write a law every single time they wanted to change the rule about something, they would delegate a broad sort of rulemaking authority to an agency with some guidelines on what it was supposed to do. And then that agency would go around handling the day-to-day rulemaking about all sorts of different topics. So they call them like alphabet soup agencies, like all of the different
EPA, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, USFWS, you know, those are the environmental ones, but we have others, Consumer Protection Board.
Yeah.
Even the FBI is governed by these things. Yeah. Yeah. Federal Highway Administration.
Yeah.
So the entirety of our federal government is broken up, and the exercising of executive power is broken up into agencies. So, you know, you don't have the president behind everything. He or she has delegated a lot of power to these various branches within their government. So I'll give the Federalist critique of the non-delegation doctrine, which is that Congress has abdicated their authority. So Congress is the one by the Constitution that has been directed to compose our laws. Congress is representative of the people and democratically accountable, right? So the director of the FDA is not necessarily as democratically accountable. If the FDA does something that people are upset with, you can't just vote that person out. You would have to vote out the president of the United States who first appointed this person. And so we're transferring power, the democratically elected branch of government who has been decided by the Constitution is in charge of writing our laws. And we're basically giving the law writing authority to these unelected bureaucrats. So that is the Federalist Society opinion on delegation. And they think that perhaps the country would run better if Congress was actually having to write the laws.
And I think it's important. They don't just think it's wrong from an outcome perspective. They think it's constitutionally impossible to do this, that the Constitution says all legislative power is in Congress. And so anyone writing down any sort of rule that isn't Congress violates their view of the Constitution. The strict version of it makes our federal government just 500 people in a room, basically, because they wouldn't be able to really do anything without that sort of delegation.
So they have a much more wooden and difficult constitution that they're working with. This is the core of textualism that Amy Coney Barrett, who is a disciple of Judge Scalia, really popularized this theory that we need to interpret the Constitution as it was meant when the Constitution was written back in 1789 or whatever it was, which has some simplistic appeal, right? Why is this too simplistic? If we're going to critique it, what's wrong with this idea? Because it makes some intuitive sense, right? We have a legislative branch. The legislative branch should be legislating. And if they just hand over power to the executive, that is problematic from a process standpoint and from it just violates the Constitution standpoint, potentially.
Yeah. So I think there's two prongs to this. One, I think it's clearly wrong from a do you want an effective government perspective, right? Because if you're going to say, you know, let's take an environmental issue, like the government right now sets like car exhaust standards for cars, right? Do you want like your representative writing the scientific formula that they're going to use in order to decide what the exact right safe amount of emissions coming out of your car is? Or do you want them to appoint someone to regulate that sort of thing and really look at it? I guess it's, do you want expertise or do you want your legislature doing these sorts of things? Which I guess experts are controversial now, so maybe I shouldn't put it that way. But then also from a constitutional standpoint, I tend to think it's really not as bad as they make it out to be, and that their solution, which is to have a judge undo it all, is much worse. So first of all, you know, tomorrow Congress could pass a law destroying the EPA if they really wanted to. If the EPA did something so egregious and so horrible that it was so politically unpopular, Congress could pass a law, Trump could sign it, and the next day there wouldn't be an EPA. And so this idea that we've totally delegated all power away from Congress is just not true, because Congress still holds the like final say on these matters, right? It's a blunt instrument, but they could theoretically rein in these agencies that they really wanted to.
I'll give my big problem with the non-delegation doctrine, which is that I think that we'll find that as this theory rises in popularity, we'll find that certain things will be an impermissible delegation of authority to the executive branch from the legislative. And those are going to happen around areas of worker protections, environmental protection.
Consumer protection is another big one.
Yeah, consumer protection. Broadly, the things that the conservative legal movement wants to fight, right? They don't like the apparatus of government insofar as it gets in the way of corporate money making. But what we won't find is in other areas where the government is more conservative or tends to align more closely with conservative movement, we won't find those issues of delegations of power. And so this just gets back to a critique of the judiciary as not an impartial, I'm just going to call balls and strikes entity, but as a basically a political branch of the government. And so instead of just acting as if you are a political branch of the government, we'll make up complicated things that make people feel dumb when you try to discuss them to the curtain that we hide the actual motive or purpose. So let's just be blunt about it, which I think that the non-delegation doctrine just exists so that judges can invalidate laws that they don't like. Or I should say, it might exist more, because the non-delegation doctrine basically doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
Right. So at one point, we had the Supreme Court back in the Lochner era of the Supreme Court, which you may have heard about, gets its name from an infamous case of the early 1900s, where the Supreme Court routinely overturned worker protections, laws that dictated that kids couldn't work in factories.
I think Lochner was about maximum hours you could work per day.
Right.
Yeah. When conservatives want to act like they're just calling balls and strikes, they're really choosing which laws agree with their conservative ideology.
Yeah.
Lochner was an example of that, where they were saying, oh, this law, it's unconstitutional because there's a right to contract that's in the Constitution.
This idea of precedent,
yeah,
which was that this was a thing back in the Lochner era as one of the many tools, as well as the right to contract, which was the basis of the Lochner case specifically, where they invented these things, but then we've just had the court ignore them for 90 years or so.
Yeah. And it was actually Scalia who really put the nail in the coffin on this one in a case. I think it was Whitman.
Whitman trucking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where he said, you know what? We're not doing this anymore. It's not okay for judges to just throw out agencies whenever we don't think that they're constitutional. But again, the conservative movement has been upset with some of their judges ruling reasonably on these cases. And so that brings us back to the Federalist Society, where we've got to really make sure that we have someone who will do what we want on the court.
And it may seem like Matt and I are just ragging on the conservative legal movement and that we're coming up with all these extremes that wouldn't actually happen in real life, right? But I'm not terribly sure that this is true, because we have Trump-appointed judges now who are making statements like, well, Lochner is still good law because it's never been directly overturned, which like might be true. I guess we'd have to go through a lot of Supreme Court records to make sure that it hadn't been formally overturned, but it has basically just died. It's died on the vine, you know, it doesn't exist anymore. And so to resurrect these things, it's a magic trick.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyways, all right. So I think that's enough on non-delegation doctrine, but basically be on the lookout for this to come back. Welcome to the Econews Report. I'm talking with Matt Simmons, law fellow at EPIC, about Judge and now Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Something else related to the broad complexity and pretty similar to the non-delegation doctrine is something called Chevron doctrine. And this has gotten a fair amount of press if you read the sort of press that that Matt and I read about the potential threat to the Chevron doctrine. And this, I think, is the thing that could most clearly be overturned in the next 5 years or significantly curtailed. So, all right, let's do the dance. How many steps are there?
There's two steps to the Chevron doctrine, and I'm a law student. And so maybe I'm weird this way, but I find it helpful to actually think about the case that created the Chevron doctrine, because I think it's a really good example of this.
All right, let's do it.
NRDC v. Chevron or Chevron v. NRDC. I don't remember who was suing who. But basically what happened was the EPA said that emitters of pollutants, in this case it was fossil fuel refineries, had to regulate the emissions from each source of pollutants. And for a long time, this was every single smokestack was a source. And so at each smokestack, there's all sorts of bad things coming out, and they would check how much there was, and they'd say, oh, you have to reduce it this much. And then under the Reagan administration, the Reagan EPA administrator, who is actually Neil Gorsuch's mother, interestingly enough, decided, you know, source is sort of one of these words that...
It's squishy.
Who knows what a source is? It could be one smokestack, or it could be a group of smokestacks that are all from the same refinery, and we're going to group them together, and we'll call that new group a source. And once you group them together like that, it's a lot easier for Chevron to smudge the numbers a little bit and say, oh, it didn't actually go up that much because we raised this stack over here and we lowered this stack over here. It gave industry a lot more flexibility in terms of what they wanted to do. And so NRDC sues, and it makes its way all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court is tasked with deciding what a source is under this document, the Clean Air Act. And they squint at it, and they look at it, and they say, you know what? It's ambiguous. Source is truly a word. It could mean each smokestack, or it could mean what the EPA now says it means, that it's a group of smokestacks altogether. It really could mean either. And there's no good explanation that we can find for which way it should go. And so what we're going to do is just look at what the agency decided to interpret it as and ask if that's reasonable or not. And as long as it's reasonable, we'll just let the agency decide what source means. And as that case illustrates, this can be a bad thing for environmental groups. NRDC lost that case. But the positive element is it gives agencies the ability to interpret their own statutes enough so that they can really try to do the best that they can given a statute that may have been written 30 or 40 years ago.
And ambiguity is the tool of Congress, right? Yeah. Getting back to the idea of the non-delegation doctrine and wanting to pass off things kind of more broadly for the agencies to figure out, Congress will intentionally write vague laws because they don't know what the best outcome is. They have this general idea often when they're passing a law, but we'll turn it over to the experts. And so getting back to this idea that the world is complicated, so we need to have people who can understand the complexities and who are subject matter experts.
So the first step is that you check to see if there's ambiguity.
Yeah.
Right? If the court is absolutely certain of what the statute says to do, you just do that.
Sometimes Congress will define a term, right?
Yeah.
So you can go to the definition section of an act, which often is near the beginning of a law, and they will have specific terms and they will define them particularly.
If the statute is ambiguous, however, you look at what the agency has decided to interpret it as, and you ask if that is reasonable. And that step, at least traditionally, has been a gimme to the agency. The court is very unlikely to say that the agency has made an unreasonable interpretation unless the agency did something really drastically untoward or whatever.
And the purposes of the Chevron deference, as it's called, are also rooted in broad principles of constitutional law, which is the judiciary recognizes that it is not necessarily the best, but that the agency, which is tasked with enforcing law, probably understands how the law works and how the world works best. And so they're not going to put in their own definition of a term that is ambiguous. They'll defer to the agency, provided that their agency is being reasonable. And so it's a restraint. It's a check on the judiciary's own power. But the Federalist Society doesn't particularly like this. Matt, young Federalist Society member, tell me what's wrong with this.
So the Federalist Society looks at the Chevron Doctrine and they say, wait a minute, we have a constitution. And the constitution says the judiciary is supposed to interpret the law. And here you have an unelected agency interpreting the law and the judiciary just deferring to their interpretation. And that is unconstitutional because what is the judiciary for if not to interpret laws? And they see the agency as sort of stepping on the judge's toes there and getting into their space too much.
Well, so the practical effect of this, though, is a transfer of power. Mm-hmm. So whereas the Congress maybe transferred power to the executive that they had in drafting laws by using ambiguous terms, and so then the executive was able to use that power to flesh out these words, now the judiciary is jealously snatching that back up. We've seen a radically more conservative judiciary as a result of the 4 years of the Trump presidency and the years where the Republican-controlled Senate basically wasn't confirming President Obama's judicial picks. So we have a lot of conservative judges at this point, and justices too. And so we're effectively giving more power to this more conservative branch of the government, probably more conservative than the Congress is, and probably more conservative than the presidency could be.
And harder to unelect because they serve for life.
Right. Yeah.
So this current batch of conservative judges and Supreme Court justices are going to last well through my life and quite a while. I think it's important to remember, often conservatives will make this sort of plea to democracy. They'll say, oh, we can't have these unelected agencies deciding how to live our lives. But they're perfectly fine with the unelected judges deciding how to live our lives. Because that's what getting rid of the Chevron doctrine would do, is it would shift power back from the agency to the judiciary. Which, if you think you're not going to win a lot of elections in the future, but you've already successfully filled the courts with a lot of conservative judges, is a smart strategic move on their part.
Look, Epic fights against the executive branch a lot, right? We have so many lawsuits going right now. I think we have somewhere between 7 or 9. We have basically Chevron cases that we're working on where we don't believe that the agencies were reasonable in their interpretation of a law passed by Congress in setting new regulations. But I do not want to lose the Chevron doctrine. I don't want it to become easier for judges to check agencies because functionally agencies are how we have a modern administrative state, how we can have a government of the 21st century that is able to regulate industry, regulate problems effectively. It would be a significant loss for us, I believe, as an environmental movement if we were to get rid of Chevron. All right, so we'll move on to our last topic, and that is standing. Standing is something you may have heard of. It is the ability of a party to bring a federal case, to make a federal case out of it. So I will go into standing, because Matt and I think actually might have different beliefs when it comes to standing. I think it's dumb. I think it is at its core the dumbest thing that we have, and it effectively just allows judges to punt cases that they don't want to hear. But here's what it is. So standing is this idea that you need to be injured by the action that you're complaining about to a judge in order to bring a case. And it's rooted in the Constitution, if you can believe it, in this idea that you need to be sufficiently injured to vigorously prosecute your case. So the Cases and Controversies Clause of the Constitution suggests that there are things that if you bring a federal case out of it might not actually be a case if you aren't injured in such a way that you would vigorously prosecute this case, which is just dumb because if you're going to bring a case, if you're spending thousands of dollars to bring a lawsuit, like you have a problem with the law and you don't think it's right and you're going to vigorously prosecute the case. There's like legal ethics that demand that you do that if you're a lawyer, that you represent your side with sufficient vigor. So it's an invention, and perhaps its roots aren't necessarily that bad, which were, again, coming from the New Deal. A lot of this is a continuing problem that the conservative legal movement has with the New Deal. But the New Deal actually created the standing doctrine, but it expanded it because we had conservative judges tossing out New Deal legislation. And so it was promoted by New Deal judges as this idea to limit the ability of people to challenge actions. And that's effectively how it works now, is that when an environmental group tries to sue, let's say, the Forest Service for an illegal timber sale, we need to go through this whole song and dance of alleging, well, I go to the area where this timber sale is going to be, and I've been there on these times in the past, and I have definite and concrete plans to go there again in the future. And if this timber sale were to occur, I would be injured because of this whole, just fill it out. And it's just dumb. It's just a gatekeeping function for the court and allows the court to just punt on doing its job. But if your goal is to prevent people who are unhappy with the law from complaining and trying to challenge a law, it might serve a great purpose, right? If you can just dismiss a case because somebody hasn't sufficiently alleged that they are going to be injured, wonderful. If you're a judge that is trying to protect bad things. So Matt, I know that you don't take necessarily as anti-standing position that I do. So defend yourself.
Okay. Yeah. Here, I'll give the argument for standing, and I'll give my argument in response to your anger.
Diatribe.
I have to put my cards on this table that I have also regularly thought standing was pretty stupid, especially when it's a case that I care about getting thrown out of court at a late stage, actually, after a lot of work has been done because the judge has decided that no one was injured. But okay, so I think at its core, standing is supposed to keep sort of nonsense out of the courts, right? And so the example that I always think of is like, if I'm watching the news and I see a bad car crash and I'm just like, ah, oh, I'm mad at that guy for crashing that car, and I call my lawyer and I'm like, I want to sue that guy for being a bad driver. The lawyer will say, yeah, you don't have standing to sue that guy. Like, nothing happened to you.
You're not involved in this.
You're not involved. No one you know was in the car crash. So I'm sorry, but the court's just going to like laugh at you and kick you out. And honestly, that totally makes sense to me. The problem comes in where a lot of modern laws have citizen supervisions, which is basically the law says anyone who's upset about X can sue. And so like the Endangered Species Act works this way, where the law says anyone who is worried about a species going extinct can sue in court to try to get whoever's responsible to stop doing that or the government to start acting on it. Those laws have clashed with the traditional notion of who can get into court. I think a really simple fix to this would just be to say, when the legislature says someone can sue, they can sue. That would be fine because it would not let nonsense into the court unless you don't agree with what the legislature thinks is important, which I think a lot of these judicial judges do. And it would allow us to not have to worry about what Tom is worrying about. But it looks like standing exists. And as long as we have to live with it, my old professor, Professor Carlson at UCLA, had, I thought, a pretty clever argument, which was, hey, if they're making you explain why this matters to you, use it as an opportunity. Find the most sympathetic plaintiff you possibly can, whose grandfather donated the land that you're now suing about, or who has a real personal connection to that species because, like, I don't know, maybe they study the species every day and their livelihood depends on the species. And if you can make your case as sympathetic as possible in those standing declarations, a judge who's really honestly thinking about it might be a little bit swayed by those standing declarations. Yeah. I should just say the reason we should talk about that is that the Federalist Society has wanted to restrict standing as much as possible in order to keep environmental plaintiffs, but all sorts of plaintiffs, out of court because they don't see injury to the environment as something you should care about. And so they don't really believe that you should be able to sue about it the way that you should be able to sue if, like, your car gets hit in an accident or if someone steals money from you. Yeah.
So I will accept standing, and I will accept your former law professor's thoughts about how to deal with the standing doctrine, because I believe in stare decisis, Matt, which is I believe that it is important to recognize that past court precedent is binding. Because I think that it's important that we have a series of laws that are consistent, that are knowable, so that we can plan our actions accordingly. Like, this is one of the broad principles of the law, is that we should know what the law is. And the function of stare decisis basically affirms that. And maybe this is our last bit on the Federalist Society, but in case you've noticed, the Federalist Society just basically disagrees with all things that I think are important. The Federalist Society is anti stare decisis. They're anti-precedent. Mm-hmm. They don't believe that precedent should have as important of a role. And this is something that Judge Barrett was grilled on. And some of the only kind of interesting things to come out of her.
She also denied climate change existing, which was noticeable.
Yeah. Yeah.
She said it was a matter of debate.
Which is how Green Diamond, in fact, describes it. She was hesitant to say whether she would respect past court precedent. And I think that most of the oxygen in the room went to Roe v. Wade, which is utterly important that we discuss this and that we understand how she feels Roe v. Wade either controls or does not control. And hence, she doesn't feel like, I don't think that she thinks that it is what she calls super precedent, which is not a thing that really exists, but that's fine. And I think that we can see the roots of the conservative legal movement's opposition to stare decisis, because it is still a longstanding opposition to the era of New Deal Supreme Court jurisprudence, which found new civil rights that may have been less explicit in the Constitution, the right to privacy, for example. And so they want to overturn these things, but they can't overturn these things unless they deny the importance of maintaining a unified set of laws. And so perhaps this is one of the things that is just broadly concerning to me, is what will the future hold if we don't treat past cases as controlling, right? And we saw a little bit of this at the Supreme Court on the issue of abortion recently with a Texas case. Texas passed a restriction on abortion that was virtually the same as a case from Louisiana that the Supreme Court decided. And four Supreme Court justices said, we don't think that this case, which is the exact same as this other case, should control this other case, which is just astounding.
From an environmental perspective, I will say there are a lot of recent 5-4 decisions that very narrowly came out the right way and protect the environment.
Massachusetts v. EPA
is the big one, which is the case that says that the EPA can regulate CO2 just a little bit sometimes.
Under existing authority from the Clean Air Act.
Right. And there was 4 very strong dissents in that case saying, I don't think we should do this. And the second I get a chance, I'm going to undo this. They didn't say that, but it was very clear in their tone.
Thomas may have said that.
Thomas actually might have said that.
That's the sort of thing that Thomas would say.
So I think with their lack of respect for stare decisis and their extreme right-wing views, we're going to start seeing a lot of judicial opinions and law that has been what we've been relying on for decades in order to try to protect the environment, just to go poof into the air. And it scares me, and I think it scares Tom too, that we're going to be living in whatever world Gorsuch, ACB, you don't even need Roberts anymore because it'll be a 6-3 court. Yeah, it's something that we should all be thinking about, is do we want 6 or 5 people deciding whether or not we can protect the environment at all? And that's where we're headed.
And that's a wrap for today's show. I hope that you've learned a bit more about the roots of the federal administrative state, which I think when probably most people say the federal administrative state, they don't say it as a warm and fuzzy thing as I think of it as. Yeah, so Amy Coney Barrett, now our Supreme Court Justice, I'm excited to see what she has to bring. And I do think that we should give her a chance to redeem herself here. People change when they have power on the Supreme Court. And though I'm skeptical that she would change, I am willing to be proven wrong. So Judge Barrett here is hoping that you find a newfound respect for precedent, and that you recognize the complexity necessary to run a modern government in the 21st century. All right, Matt, thank you. Thank you for joining me. This is Matt's first Eco News Report. I'm thrilled to have him in the office. So thank you, Matt, and thank you all for listening to the Eco News Report. Join us here on This Time and Channel next week for more environmental news from the North Coast of California.